It's impossible to understand the Great War without reference to the memoirs of those who were there. Books and battlefields are inextricably linked. To view those dusty lanes of Flanders or the vast open fields of the Somme through the eyes of the men who were there gives us different insight, new understanding of the old front line. Something a little bit different this week, books and battlefields. The first in what I hope will become a regular spot on the podcast, where we look at books and we connect them to places on the battlefields that we know today. Now, I know many of you listen to this podcast and probably curse me for the amount of books that I recommend or mention, and I know many of you go on to seek them out. So this will take that one step further, where we'll look at some particular books and we'll see how they connect to parts of the Western Front and how they connect to battlefield locations. Now, what sort of books are we talking about here? Well, we're not talking about Le MacDonald or the Holt's Guide or Battleground Europe books. What I'm really talking about here are the memoirs of the Great War. And these are really, really important in our understanding of this period. I'm often asked by people, in particular aspiring battlefield guides, what books should I read? Now, there's a whole plethora of titles on the First World War. You don't have to go very far on the internet to find these. And as I mentioned, there are the books by Lynn MacDonald, Martin Middlebrook, Richard Van Emden, Peter Hart. The list goes on and on. And those are all really superb books and really important to read those. But building up knowledge and understanding of the First World War is like building up layers of knowledge. And those sort of books and guidebooks, they give you one layer of that knowledge, or perhaps several layers of that knowledge. But the memoirs are all part of increasing the depth of your layers, your depth of understanding of the Great War, the war on the Western Front, and what it was like to be there. Now, I was very lucky in the 80s and 90s to interview all those Great War veterans. But even when you look at the size of the British Army in the Great War, even the 350 that I spoke to was only a drop in the ocean. They can't possibly speak for every single soldier. And that's where the memoirs of the First World War help to supplement our knowledge. And also, for those who never had an opportunity to speak to a veteran, this is the next best thing. This is where you can tap into their thoughts. Now, these sort of books, they have their own problems, because many of them were written a long time after the events, and these men have had plenty of time to think about the things that they experienced and perhaps put their own slant on it. But I think if you're looking for an idea of what it was like to live on a day-to-day basis in the front line, what it was like to be out of the trenches and spend time in villages and towns behind the front, what it was like to march along the long roads of France, what it was like to see your friends cut down alongside you, and what it was like to survive and go home and live with that. These memoirs are all part of our insight into that type of understanding. And in those, for myself anyway, in those early years of visiting the Great War battlefields in the early 1980s, before guidebooks, that time it was Rose Coombs Before Endeavour's Fade was really the only guidebook that covered the whole area. The memoirs were the way in which you could go to the battlefield and study it from a particular angle and get to know bits of ground and connect those bits of ground to stories that you'd read in these memoirs. And in those days, there were a lot of second-hand bookshops. I could go down to a place like Worthing with an old army knapsack and £20 in my pocket and come back with quite a few titles connected to the First World War. Now, that's not possible because there are so few bookshops now, and also obviously the price of these things has risen. But even so, if you search around, and places like eBay are good places to look for some of these out-of-print memoirs of the First World War, you can find them often at very cheap prices. And my recommendation is, if you are building up a Great War library or you have one and you want to enhance it, go back to these old books. The most recent publications, you know, they're good. There's no doubting that. But these old books, like I say, were part and parcel of those old days of exploring the Western Front, when this was the source material that you could use to understand the battlefields that you were exploring on foot, by car, whatever it was. And for that reason, they hold for me quite a special place. And when I think back to the people that I used to go across with or knew that travelled along those battlefields in those days, people like my old friend John Dray, who I often mention on here, but others like John Giles, the founder of the Western Front Association, they all used to talk about this wavelength of the Great War, tuning into this wavelength. And I think that until you begin to read some of these memoirs, the classic memoirs by those who were there, you can't begin to do that, really. And by connecting it to place, to landscape, it means that your view of the Western Front battlefields will change forever. You'll travel around now and you'll see a field which to most people is just nothing, but that's the field in which a certain author took his route to the front line, first saw tanks, lost his best mate, and suddenly that landscape is different. It means more. It has depth in a way that it perhaps didn't do before, as you could casually walk or drive by and just see that field. So I would always say, seek out these memoirs, look for these older books on the Great War. But where to start, and that's what I hope to do in Books and Battlefields, the Books and Battlefields part of the Old Frontline podcast. And for the first of these, we'll start on the Somme battlefields, a place, as if you listen to this podcast, you'll know is very special to me, a place that I lived for many years and a place that I've been visiting now for almost 40 years. And we're going to begin in one little village which will tie together three separate authors of the Great War. And that village is the village of Bazentin-le-Petit. Now, Bazentin-le-Petit was one of a twin pair of villages, Bazentin-le-Petit and Bazentin-le-Grand. I often think it must have been some sort of French joke, because petit means small and grand means big, but Bazentin-le-Grand is tiny and Bazentin-le-Petit is much bigger. Whatever, the two Bazentins sat behind the German lines for the first 2 years of the First World War. The Germans swept through this region in the advance towards the coast in 1914. They met the French army that was fighting just down the road at Montauban, at Guillemont, and on the outskirts of Albert. And then where that fighting concluded, that was where both sides dug in, and the Germans constructed their line on this southern sector of the Somme battlefields. And the village of Bazentin found itself a couple of miles behind the very front line. The nearest front line positions from Bazentin was the village of Mametz in one direction and the village of Montauban in the other direction. Bazentin was a small village. Possibly in the early months of the Great War, the civilians continued to live here, but generally when villages like this were in close proximity to the German defences, whether that's the first, second or third line trenches, they moved the civilians out. This became a military zone, because for the Germans, being occupying forces, they didn't want French people there who could perhaps pass information on as to what German fortifications and units were in that area. But also, just like behind the British lines, they didn't want to be responsible for civilians, particularly once things like poison gas came along, because they barely had enough anti-gas measures and masks for their own men, rather than having to worry about civilians. So civilians were moved out and displaced, and lots of people from these Somme villages moved further into France or went right across into eastern France or up to some of the big cities like Lille. And many of them, of course, never came back. And it's a familiar story on the Somme. You know, if you look at the average census before the war and then the average post-war census, and these are now online on the Somme Archives website and they make fascinating reading, you can see that on average a good third of the people just never returned for all sorts of reasons, because by the end of the war this village of Bazentin was completely destroyed. But in 1916 that was yet to come. The village was a billeting village for the German units, the infantry units that held the front lines between Montauban and Mametz. There were gun positions here. Some of the German heavy artillery were around the village. Beyond it was a large area of several pieces of woodland, Bazentin wood, Mametz wood, flat iron copse, as we would call it. And in the valleys there, that's where some of the German field artillery was located. So it was a main part of a main supply route to the front line. And there was quite a big chateau in the village close to the church where an individual called Jean-Baptiste Lamarck had once lived. Now, to us, Lamarck is a name that is barely known, but he was the French equivalent of Darwin. He came up with his own ideas about the evolution of species, and he is a much celebrated scientist and writer in France. Quite a few places in and around Albert have streets named after him. There's a school named after him in Albert. And this chateau that was his birthplace and the place where he conducted a lot of his research, he'd left it at one point in his life, and there's a nice connection in some ways to the history of the Great War, that he went off to fight in the Seven Years' War. And when you read some of his accounts of it, it is like reading the experiences of a soldier who fought around Bazentin in the Great War. The chateau in 1914 was a museum because Lamarck had lived in the late 18th century and early 19th century. And by the time of the Great War, he'd been dead for nearly 100 years. And the place where he'd lived had become a museum to his work. And when the Germans came into Bazentin in 1914, they took this building over. They carefully removed all of the artifacts and items connected to him. They didn't loot them or cart them off. They removed them, possibly to Bapaume or Peronne, which would have been the nearest army headquarters at that time. And they turned the chateau into a medical establishment, the equivalent of a dressing station to receive wounded coming back from the frontline positions on this southern sector of the Somme front. Now, in the first 2 years, this village was pretty much untouched by the war. Some long-range French or eventually long-range British shells might well have reached it. But on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, on the 1st of July 1916, the villages of Mametz and Montauban, which had been the two frontline positions from which soldiers billeted in Bazentin had gone to the trenches, those positions were captured by British troops, and gradually the fight got nearer. And on the 14th of July 1916, the British broke through at Mametz Wood, came up into Bazentin Wood. The Leicester's Brigade of the 6th, 7th, 8th and 9th Leicester's fought there. The Welsh Division had cleared the last parts of Mametz Wood, and the 33rd Division passed through them and came up through the village to continue with the fight to the next area of woodland, which was High Wood, a battlefield that would occupy the British for the course of the next 2 months. And once Bazentin was captured on the 14th of July, it became our staging post, really, to continue that advance and a staging post for the attacks towards High Wood itself. So in the next 2 months, until High Wood fell on the 15th of September 1916, unit after unit passed through here. So when we stand in the centre of the village of Bazentin-le-Petit today, every building, like all of these Somme villages that we see, dates from the 1920s or later. Lamarck's chateau was never rebuilt, but there's a tree-lined avenue going down to a sculptured bust of Lamarck, a monument to him. And a more recent memorial to him is the form of a metal giraffe made out of parts of what looks like bits of 2CV cars. And why a giraffe? Well, his theory of the evolution of species was built around giraffes and their necks, and the necks being long enough to be able to get them up to the trees and eat the food, and they survive when other animals that had shorter necks didn't. I mean, I'm not an expert on the evolution of species, but the giraffe is a symbol of Lamarck's life and work on this subject. So we've had a bit of history of this particular location, the village of Bazentin-le-Petit, and we're going to look at three different authors now and three different books that connect us to some of the story here in that summer of 1916 during the Battle of the Somme. The first of these books is Warrior by Graham Seaton Hutchinson. And I've got the book in front of me now, and you might hear in the background we turn pages here and there as we do this sequence. It's a red-covered book. There is an edition with a dust wrapper. I don't have that. This particular one that I've got is signed by Graham Seaton Hutchinson. Many of his books, I would say, are signed. I think he liked to sign his books. And it was a book that was published in the mid-1930s, I think around about 1935-36. There's no particular date on this one. This is a first edition from published in London by Hutchinson. And he dedicates the book as follows. The qualities of courage, patience, endurance, loyalty, sacrifice, these are they of the comradeship of warriors. To those possessed of the warrior's heart, this work is dedicated. Graham Seaton Hutchinson was a pre-war regular soldier. He was working as an intelligence officer in Rhodesia when the war broke out, and he came back to Britain and joined his regiment, the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, and was posted to their 2nd Battalion in the trenches near Bois Grenier in October of 1914, just as the front there began to go static. A lot of the first part of the book describes the conditions at that time and describes the primitive nature of many of the trenches, with no proper shelters, no dugouts, and the men were living really in what was in many cases a flooded ditch. Hutchinson, or Hutchie as his men called him, and we'll come on to that later, he became the machine gun officer of the 2nd Argyles, and when the Machine Gun Corps was formed in 1915, he became a Machine Gun Corps officer and part of his brigade's machine gun company, and eventually they would form part of the 33rd Division, and he was in the 100th Company Machine Gun Corps and eventually the 33rd Battalion Machine Gun Corps. And we jump forward now through the book. We're not going to go through all the several hundred pages of it, but we'll jump forward to a point during the Battle of the Somme where he comes into the village of Bazentin-le-Petit, where, in a virtual way, we are too. Hutchie had spent quite a few months in that Bois Grenier hoop line sector up in northern France, got accustomed to trench warfare, became this machine gun officer, and gradually by 1916, at the time of the Battle of the Somme, machine guns were taking on more and more of an importance. And next week's podcast, we'll be speaking to Richard Fisher about the work of the Machine Gun Corps and Vickers Guns in the Great War, and there'll be a tie-in, of course, with Hutchie, which I'll mention later on in this sequence. But this is how he describes his machine gun company's entry into the battlefield here around Bazentin on the 14th of July 1916. The full tragedy of modern warfare was laid bare to the eyes of many for the first time. The ribaldry tossed from mouth to mouth was the camouflage for fresh horrors, which nearly every step revealed. The bloated carcasses of animals with distended stomachs lay in every ditch, and each bend of the road multiplied the bodies mutilated beyond recognition, distorted from almost every semblance of human form, lying everywhere unburied. Fear was in many hearts, fear of the unknown. The air reverberated with the thunder of bombardment. Great shells hurled themselves through the trees, shorn of their summer splendour, torn and jagged, and buried themselves beneath the undergrowth of Mamet's Wood. A burnt-out ambulance and abandoned stretchers, soaked with blood, now clotted brown and fly-brown, piled themselves beside lines and groups of English soldiers who had perished before the spluttering fire of machine guns, which for long hours had seemed riveted to the corners of the wood. Hutchison and his machine gun company then go on to set up their guns around the village close to the quarry, and were walk from the church near to where Lamarck's house was, down a little road that comes off the main road that runs from Pozières through Bazentin towards Longueval, and that'll take us out to the eastern side of Bazentin village, and the remains of the old quarry is still there to this day. You walk down this long straight road out into the fields, it gets to a T-junction, and you go to your left, and the quarry is just on the right-hand side. Two things happened to Hutchie in this area that I always think of whenever I come here. And the first of those is what he describes as the death of the lad, who's a young soldier in his machine gun company, who gets hit by shell fire and is badly wounded in the legs. And this is Hutchie's description of what happened. "It's a miracle if he lives," says the sergeant. "Those legs are pulp. They'll have to come off." Many minutes passed. Then the lad shuddered a little and opened his eyes. He winced, as in his recovering consciousness he sought to move, and the pang of pain shot through his body. Tears flooded his eyes as he realised his impotence. "Hutchie," he whispered, one of those rare occasions in soldiering days in which a man addressed me by the familiar name by which I was known by the rank and file. "Is it bad?" I bent my ear to the strained words. "A smack in the legs, that's all, kid. Just stick it," I replied. "Then we'll be able to get you down the line." The wounded man smiled around him at the familiar faces, then closed his eyes. There was nothing to do but wait. Hutchie stayed with him, and It was clear as the day moved on that the young lad was not going to survive, as he describes. The lad's face paled, his lips blue, and a troubled look came for a moment into his eyes. Then they brightened, an expression of ecstasy lighting the face. "Look, look, the cross," he whispered. I glanced across the lip of the quarry, and the eyes of the others crouching beside me followed my own. As it was suspended between Martinpuy and High Wood, there appeared to be a brilliant light with wide wings shaped like some giant aeroplane. It hovered above the scene of carnage. A shiver passed through the wounded man's body. For a moment he clung tightly to me, then the whole body relaxed. I glanced down quickly. Death looked from the eyes of a machine gunner, but a smile lay on the blood-flecked lips. I've never, ever been able to identify who the lad was. It's clear here and there in some of the passages of Warrior, and indeed some of other Hutchinson's books, that he not exaggerates, but he uses a bit of alliteration to perhaps tell a wider story. But that doesn't diminish the power of this, really. A young lad dying in his officer's arms, seeing the cross above him. It's a story that you read many times in the accounts of soldiers in the Great War. But I was thinking it's quite something to come here to the quarry at Bazentin with Hutchie's book and read this passage as you sit here reflecting on those events more than a century ago. The other incident that Hutchie describes in this part of his book is the machine gun barrage in August 1916 of the far side of High Wood. By this stage of the conflict, machine guns are being used more and more like artillery, and Hutchie's machine gun company lays down a machine gun barrage to deny the Germans entry into a bit of ground to allow a unit to attack an objective and to stop the Germans sending in a counterattack or any reinforcements. In the book, he talks about a million round barrage, and this is something that I've discussed with Richard Fisher in the next episode of the podcast, so I won't spoil the outcome of that. But whatever, it was certainly a powerful barrage, and it's an indication within a book like this just how the war was changing. Hutchie came at a primitive moment in trench warfare with muddy ditches and basic barbed wire on wooden stakes. And a year later, here on the Somme, this is an industrial war with killing on an industrial scale. And the power of industry and the power of what had become this total war is everywhere to be seen, and can be also seen in almost every word in Hutchinson's description of the fighting here on the Somme in 1916. Hutchie went on to serve in many other battles. There's great descriptions of the fighting in Arras here in 1917. At one point, towards the end of the Battle of Passchendaele, his unit occupied the bunkers around Tynecott, in what is now Tynecott Cemetery. And some of the photographs that he took himself with his own camera appear in this book. They are of machine guns at those very bunkers that existed at that time in the area that is now the cemetery. And then one of the key moments in the book in April 1918 during the Battle of the Lys is when, as the 33rd Battalion Machine Gun Corps, with a huge amount of machine gun firepower now at his disposal, he sets up his guns on the Hoogenacker Ridge close to Hazebrouck. And there, he, as he says, he saves the Channel ports. He stops the German army using his machine gun firepower. Now, again, I suspect that it wasn't just Hutchie and his guns doing that. It was a wider picture of the events unfolding during the Battle of the Lys. But it's another example of how the locations described in memoirs like this can be so powerfully linked to places that we visit on the battlefield today. And when you go to the Hoogenacker Ridge and stand there close to where the ruins of the Hoogenacker windmill once stood, it's only a low ridge, like so many in that area of Flanders and French Flanders. And you think of the guns, you think of the Germans advancing through the mist, and the whole thing comes alive. Hutchinson's first book was not Warrior, it was the history of his machine gun unit, the 33rd Battalion Machine Gun Corps. And again, one thing we'll discuss in next week's podcast is the republishing of that book that's coming up very soon. And that's really good. It's good that some of these memoirs and some of these books connected to the First World War, which are quite difficult to find, are gradually being reprinted. Quite a lot during the centenary, but that task still continues. And it means that more and more of this material is available to us, and that can only be a good thing. So we've looked at Hutchie in the quarry, and we're not going very far now. We're going to walk where we are, just in front of the quarry. We're going to continue up the track towards a British cemetery that we can see just in the distance ahead of us. But before we get there, there's a French civilian cemetery on the right-hand side, and that'll link us to our next book. Our next book is Goodbye to All That by Robert Graves, and we've come from the track into the French civilian graves of Bazentin-le-Petit-Communal Cemetery. There are a couple of war graves in here, one of a soldier of the Law North Lancs and an officer of the Gloucestershire Regiment, and these burials were made here during the Battle of the Somme and have remained here ever since. But looking around us, the bulk of the graves are French civil graves of people of Bazentin who have died since the Great War, and there are one or two headstones in here that somehow almost survived the First World War. But Robert Graves, whose classic First World War memoir, The Experiences of a Young Officer on the Western Front, there are so many editions of it. And I mean, I used to have a little paperback version that I used to take with me to the battlefields. In fact, when I went across to the Somme for the first time in 1982, I took that book with me and read it as I tramped round the Somme with my dad. And when I got back, I wrote to Robert Graves via his publisher and said how I'd taken his book across to the old battlefields and I'd visited some of the places and described some of the things I'd seen. And to my disappointment, I never got a reply. But a few years ago, after I moved up here to Yorkshire, I went to a talk in Sheffield based on a new edition of his collected war poetry. In fact, it was the first time all of his war poetry had been brought together into a single volume. And his great-granddaughter was there, and she read some of the poetry, which was really quite moving to listen to. But she said in part of her preliminary talk that in the last years of his life, he'd completely rejected all mention of the war. He didn't want to have anything to do with it. He didn't want to be known as a war poet, and he wouldn't talk about the war. So if my letter ever reached him at Mallorca, where he was living at that time in those last years of his life, I suspect it probably ended up in the fire or the bin. And it's understandable. But this book takes him, his story from before the Great War at public school to joining the army in the early stages of the war. He initially served with the Welsh Regiment and was posted as a platoon commander to one of their battalions in northern France in 1915, where he served in the Coinchy Brickstacks area. And his accounts of being at the Brickstacks really are quite something to read. And I've used some of the material in my upcoming book on the Forgotten Front because it's such a vivid description of what life was like amongst those Brickstacks just outside that small village of Coinchy in northern France. Robert Graves had a habit of upsetting people throughout his life when you read the accounts of him. And he wasn't popular amongst the other officers of the Welsh Regiment. One of the things that he used to do was talk about his cousin. Now, Robert Graves's full name was Robert von Ranke Graves. Von Ranke was his mother's maiden name. She was German. And his cousin was Lieutenant von Ranke of the German Field Artillery, who had been responsible for the partial destruction of Reims Cathedral in 1914 with his field guns, which had been cited by the French as a war crime. And I think Graves boasting in the mess of the Welsh Regiment about what his lieutenant cousin had been up to didn't win him a lot of friends. So he transfers to the 1st Battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and there he meets Siegfried Sassoon. They served together for a while in that battalion in a quiet period leading up to the Battle of the Somme in the ground above Fricourt at the Bois Français. And they both lose a very, very good friend there, David Thomas, who tragically dies after being shot in the neck. And his grave is up on the approach to that high ground at Point 110 Cemetery. And that's an area that we'll walk another day in this podcast, a fascinating area of the Somme battlefields. Graves then transfers to the 2nd Battalion, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and then he comes with them to take part in the Battle of the Somme here around Bazentin in July of 1916. On the 20th of July, they make an attack towards High Wood, and it's in that assault that Robert Graves is badly wounded, picked up by stretcher bearers and brought here to the area close to Bazentin Cemetery, which is being used as an aid post, a regimental aid post on the battlefield. So this is the first port of call for wounded men coming back from the area of the attack, from the battlefield, brought to a place like this. When you stand here today, you can see that the ground rises above and beyond where the cemetery is located to an area where there's trees now, and this gave this position some protection from any direct observation coming from the direction of High Wood. So it meant that when men like Graves were wounded trying to attack that position, they could be brought back here into a place of safety and treated. And the medical officer here at that time was Dr. Dunn, and we mentioned him in the Polygon Wood episode of the podcast because he was the medical officer then in September 1917 of the Second Royal Welsh Fusiliers and took part in an action there, which if you want to find out more about that, you can go back to the Polygon Wood episode and listen to that one. But here in this attack, he had a lot of casualties coming back into this position, and Graves was lying fairly seriously wounded on a stretcher near to the civilian graves. And this is what he describes in his book. "One piece of shell went through my left thigh, high up near the groin. I must have been at the full stretch of my stride to escape emasculation. The wound over the eye was made by a little chip of marble, possibly from one of the Bazantin cemetery headstones. Later, I had it cut out, but a smaller piece has since risen to the surface under my right eyebrow, where I keep it for a souvenir. This and a finger wound which split the bone probably came from another shell bursting in front of me, but a piece of shell had also gone in 2 inches below the point of my right shoulder blade and came out through my chest, 2 inches above the right nipple. My memory of what happened then is vague. Apparently Dr. Dunn came up through the barrage with a stretcher party, dressed my wound and got me down to the old German dressing station on the north end of Mametz Wood. I remember being put on the stretcher and winking at the stretcher-bearer sergeant who had just said, 'Old Gravy's got it all right.' They laid my stretcher in the corner of the dressing station where I remained unconscious for more than 24 hours. Late that night, Colonel Crashaw came back from High Wood and visited the dressing station. He saw me lying in the corner, and they told him I was done for. The next morning, July the 21st, clearing away the dead, they found me still breathing and put me on an ambulance for Highley, the nearest field hospital." Now, Robert Graves's colonel, having seen him in the corner of this dressing station, having been told that he was done for, that he was going to die, thought that Graves had died of wounds. So he sat down in his dugout as the battle was now over, and he began to mull through the casualties. And part of his responsibility as a commanding officer was to write to the families of his officers who'd been killed. He then began to pen the following letter to Robert Graves's mother. "Dear Mrs. Graves, I very much regret to have to write and tell you your son has died of wounds. He was very gallant and was doing so well and is a great loss. He was hit by a shell and very badly wounded and died on the way down to the base, I believe. He was not in bad pain and our doctor managed to get across and attend to him at once. We have had a very hard time and our casualties have been large. Believe me, you have all our sympathy in your loss, and we have lost a very gallant soldier. Please write to me if I can tell you or do anything." But Graves was still alive. He was evacuated down to the casualty clearing station. He remained unconscious for a while, but eventually came into consciousness and was able to talk to the medical officers and eventually able to send message to his family to say that he wasn't dead. He hadn't died of his wounds. He was still alive. But this was not before that they had placed an obituary in the Times newspaper, and his great friend who he'd served with, Siegfried Sassoon, had read that obituary and written a poem in memory of his friend Robert Graves. So as we stand here amongst the civilian graves in Bazantin Cemetery and we look at the marble headstones that are here now, we wonder which one of these, of the older ones, was the one that wounded Graves again, having been wounded going over, brought back here to this supposed place of safety. A shell had struck one of the tombstones and they'd wounded him again. And that little fragment, as he mentions in the book, remained in him until many years later, until it popped out and he kept it as a souvenir. Really quite incredible. This wasn't quite the end of Graves's war. He did actually return to his battalion later on, but he wasn't a well man. He was not fit for active service. And Dr. Dunn, Captain Dunn, the medical officer, had him sent back. and he remained in the depot of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers until his later discharge. Graves was the only one of the major war poets not to be awarded the Military Cross in the Great War, not because he wasn't brave. He was, when you read the accounts of other people, they had a very, very high regard for him as a soldier. But as we discovered with his story of recounting that his cousin, Leutnant von Ranke, had destroyed Reims Cathedral, Graves had a habit of upsetting people, and I often wonder whether his name came under the eyes of a colonel somewhere as a recommendation for an award, but they refused to sign it, refused to pass it on. He was, in 1917, recommended for a Russian decoration, but then the Russian Revolution took place and he never received it. But I guess in many ways he had the last laugh, having been so grievously wounded on the Somme in July 1916. He had a very long life. He was the last of the Great War, the major Great War poets, to die, finally passing away in Spain in December 1985. Graves, for us, as people interested in the First World War, we know him through Goodbye to All That, but his writing and his work went way beyond the Great War. He really wanted to be known as a love poet, but I guess for most people, he's best known for the dramatisation of his work I, Claudius by the BBC. And yes, while I can read those great works of literature that he produced, for me, standing here in Bazentin, or following him through the streets of Bethune, or in the fields where the Quincy Brickstacks once stood, it will always be Goodbye to All That, one of the earliest books, the memoirs that I've read on the Great War that will always stay with me, will always be impactful when you come to visit places like this. So for our final book, we're going to leave the quarry, we're going to leave the cemetery, we're going to walk back down the lane past the quarry, continue to where it becomes a track, cart track, that takes us onto the Contal Maison along of our road. We'll turn off left there and a little bit up before the Bazentin Crucifix at Crucifix Corner. There's a track goes off to the left and rises up the ground, and we'll walk that, and it takes us to a little clump of trees out in the fields just on the crest of the ridge, and that will be our next stop. Where we've walked to on this ridge above Bazentin, if we stand on the track and look to our right, we can see the dark mass of trees of high wood in the far distance. And swinging round to our right again, another dark mass of trees, which is Delville Wood and the village of Longueval just in front of it. This is the vast open landscape across this massive killing ground of 1916, where attack after attack went in. In the little clump of trees and bushes just to the left of the track, looking back towards Bazentin itself, is the ruins of the old Bazentin windmill. Now, I've never seen a photograph of this. There's no photographs of it that I know of in the German archives, and I've never seen a pre-war postcard of it, so I'm presuming that it was probably a ruin even at the time of the First World War. The one at Pozières on the high ground there, the Pozières windmill, was a stone tower. And I would guess that that was probably typical of the construction of this type of windmill in this region, because there are a few surviving examples of these in villages behind the lines beyond Albert towards Amiens. But whether it stood proud or not, windmills are only built on high points, and from here we can see what an advantageous position this is in terms of a battlefield. In this case, not so much from defending it, because this was part of the route to the front line and where the jump-off trenches were to take you forward into an attack. No, what we're looking at here is the importance of this position from a signalling point of view, because this became a signalling post for battalion-level signallers. Now, signallers are an important link in the chain of command anywhere on a battlefield, because on a modern battlefield as it was of the Great War, but without modern communications, they relied on fixed communications, telephone lines, but also signallers like this to use lamps, often Lucas lamps, with very bright bulbs, where they would use those to send Morse, they'd flash and use Morse code to send messages across the battlefield, or they could use flags and use semaphore. So a position like this was part of the rear link chain, really, for messages coming back from the battlefield. So in an attack on High Wood, signallers would go forward with the assault. They would then relay information by flag or lamp back to a position like this. Then they would then relay those messages back to another position or back to headquarters further away. So that way that information could be gathered on the battlefield and sent back. But of course, it could easily be broken down by battlefield conditions. The shelling of an exposed position like this could wipe out all of the signallers, and your ability to send that message back was then completely lost. So this was the frustration, really, that commanders had not being directly in touch with their men in the way that a generation later in the Second World War they were. So who was here and what book? Well, the man that was here in July 1916 in the same battalion as Robert Graves, the 2nd Battalion Royal Welsh Fusiliers, was Frank Richards. Now, this is not Frank Richards who wrote Billy Bunter. This is Frank Richards, a Welsh miner, who was befriended by both Siegfried Sassoon and Robert Graves and encouraged to write his memoirs. Graves helped him in constructing his account from the point of view of an ordinary soldier. Frank Richards went right through the war in the ranks. Along the way, he picked up a Distinguished Conduct Medal and Military Medal. And this book is greatly important because of that, because it gives us a voice from the ranks. There were very few books being published at this time in the 1930s when this came out that were the voice of ordinary soldiers. And the edition that I have in front of me is not the first edition. I do have a hardback edition of it, but this is a 1964 Faber and Faber paperback edition of Old Soldiers Never Die. Now, these 1960s and 70s Faber paperback books that covered all sorts of different aspects of literature and poetry, I really like them. They're very much of that sort of period. And this is quite a handy little size to pop in your knapsack and take with you on a walk around the battlefields. So this one is a well-used, well-worn, and indeed well-travelled copy that has come with me on numerous occasions to the battlefields. Richards was a reservist when the war broke out. He'd served in India before the war, and the success of this book led to another one called Old Soldier Sahib, which is about his time in India. Not as popular, but it gives you a fascinating insight into the regular soldier's experience in India before the Great War and the language that soldiers developed from their time in India. But Richards, as I say, was a reservist. And the thing I like about this book is that it begins and ends in a pub. He's at a pub when they get their call-up orders to rejoin their regiment and go off to war. And at the end of it, he's in the pub where the survivors, his comrades, are sat with him. And they're looking at each other, recounting some of their stories, having a few drinks. And the night ends with the refrains of that popular soldier's song, which they all sing together, Old Soldiers Never Die. And that's how the title of this book comes about. Old soldiers never die, they simply fade away. Or alternatively, old soldiers never die, the young ones wish they would. But the book takes you through this incredible journey of places that Frank Richards went to during his war service, from, like Hutchie, the primitive trenches of northern France around Fromelles. He takes part in the Christmas truce. He's in the line at Bois Grenier and Hoop Lines. And then the action at the Red Dragon Crater in June of 1916, which is one of the occasions in which he's decorated for his bravery. And of course, right through the fighting on the Somme and then later at Arras, at Ypres, he describes the occasion in which Captain Dunn, the medical officer, tears off his medical badges and takes command of the remnants of the battalion at that critical moment, right through to the final phase of the war. It is an incredible account, and when you look at it, you see just how long one man could easily spend on the front line. For some men, their war was very, very short, but for some, like Richards, it was a long war that took them down so many parts of the Western Front. But here we are at the windmill, the remains of the windmill at Bazenta, and this is his description of what happened to him here from Old Soldiers Never Die. 8 of us and the brigade signalling corporal were detailed off to form a transmitting station between High Wood and brigade headquarters, which was situated on the fringe of Mamet's Wood. No telephones would be carried, and our station would receive messages by flag from the signallers with the attacking force, which we would transmit to brigade by heliograph or flag. The position that we had to take up was by a large mill about 600 yards this side of High Wood. The mill was built on some rising ground, which made it a very prominent landmark. We had a good view of everything from here, but we also found that when we were exchanging messages with the wood, the enemy would have an equally good view of us, especially when we were flag-wagging. An old soldier of the Cameronians, who was now a brigade signaller, an old soldier of the Royal Welsh, who was now a brigade runner, and the corporal were the only ones I knew of our station. I was wondering how the other five would conduct themselves if we were heavily shelled. The Cameronian and I fixed our heliograph and telescope up, and at 8 a.m. we were in communication with brigade. Shortly after this, the enemy began shelling us, and by 10 a.m. they'd put up one of the worst barrages that I was ever under. 12-inch, 8-inch, 5.9s and whiz-bang shells were bursting around us continually, and this lasted during the whole of the day. North, south, east and west, it was raining shells, and we seemed to be the dead centre of it all. The barrage of the previous day was a flea-bite to this one. The ground shook and rocked, and we were continually having to rest the heliograph. When receiving a message, the smoke of the bursting shells and the earth and dust that was being thrown up constantly obscured our vision, and we could only receive a word now and then. Not long after, Richards and his signallers came under direct machine gun fire from the direction of High Wood, and this position for them became pretty much untenable. There they were in broad daylight in the open on a high point, carrying out their signalling duties in full view of the enemy, and they were going to be wiped out if they stayed there much longer. So they ended up taking their signallers' position up somewhere else on the battlefield and relaying the information from there. But when we stand here, we have this fantastic vista across this part of the Somme battlefield. We can see the ground over which all those successive attacks went in. We can connect to Old Soldiers Never Die just by this overgrown pile of rubble here, aside a cart track on these dusty lanes of Picardy. And again, it's all part of the power of how these books bring us onto these landscapes of the First World War and bring them alive. And here, just in this one place at Bazentin, we've seen the accounts of Hutchie in the quarry and the loss of the lad, the boy, who had died in his arms. Robert Graves being wounded, he went over the top and a fragment of a headstone chipping off like shrapnel and hitting him again. And here at Bazentin Windmill, Frank Richards, highly decorated soldier, an incredible account of an ordinary man in the Great War. This is the joy of the discovery of memoirs like these, and the joy of coming to the places that they connect us to, and perhaps seeing familiar battlefields in a new light and through new eyes, through the eyes of those who were there. There'll be details of all of these books on the podcast website, oldfrontline.co.uk, and I hope this episode has inspired you, if not to read these books, some of the books you may have in your own library, take them off the shelves, read those pages, and think about where they might next connect you the next time you walk the old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCorps. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.